The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Avoiding a Fade-Out. Movie theaters in an industry that has been struggling for years are facing an uncertain future. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Movie Theaters' Uncertain Future. Theaters at Options Scramble to Avoid Curtain Call. Written by Laura Bromette. The pandemic kicked the movie theater industry when it was down, causing many theaters to file for bankruptcy and some to never open again. 2 years later, a handful that are still hanging on now have a choice to make: pivot to incorporating multiple revenue streams or rely on the community to once again go to movie theaters and support their neighborhood business. Pandemic aside, movie theater owners knew the business model of making money through the sale of theater tickets, soda, and candy was in trouble. For the past 15 years, the disruptor, for the most part, has been the streaming services. Netflix started 24 years ago with its DVD rental by mail service and went public in 2002, the same year that domestic movie theater ticket sales peaked at nearly $1.6 billion. According to the National Association of Theater Owners. Ticket sales have trended downward since, as Netflix introduced its streaming service in 2007, and dozens of other streaming services now flood the market. That has now triggered some of the Triangle's noted theater owners to add new revenue streams to offset the drop in ticket sales. Bill Peebles, owner of the Rialto Theater in Raleigh, says hosting special events has helped support the theater's revenue stream. If you and your partner want to come in and see your favorite movie on the big screen, you can provide us with the Blu-ray and we will rent you the theater, he says. If you are into video gaming, you can bring your console and we can tie it into the system. You can play with your control or from anywhere in the theater on the big screen. Shifting sands. Despite fewer people going to the movies, Hollywood's blockbuster offerings, especially tied to sought-after brands such as The Avengers, Jurassic Park, and Star Wars, kept the gross revenue numbers up until the pandemic hit. Box office revenue reached $11.9 billion in 2018 and $11.4 billion in 2019, according to NATO. But in 2020, with the arrival of COVID-19, box office revenue plummeted to $2.2 billion. Many theaters were reopened in 2021, allowing sales to creep up to $4.5 billion, but the time spent in lockdown altered movie-watching habits for many, with the ease of streaming still being appealing, even as COVID-related restrictions lifted and theaters reopened. Now, fighting a heavily saturated streaming market for the attention of audiences, local and independent theaters in the Triangle are making plays to ensure their survival. Armed with limited funds, creativity, a note of desperation, and a passion for film, movie theaters are in an uphill battle to secure their place in the Triangle community. And unlike national multiplex chains, independent and locally owned theaters often possess more freedom to reinvent their brands. Kevin Callahan believes the Lumina Theater in Chapel Hill will be one of the companies to survive as the locally owned theater looks to revamp its offerings. Callahan, a local restaurateur dubbed the creative director of the Lumina, plans to open a bar and restaurant inside the venue. The shared experience of strangers gathered in a dark room and hearing people gasp or cry together is why Netflix and other streaming services won't wipe out theaters, he says. Television came along and theaters were going to die. VHS came along, theaters were going to die. Cable came along, theaters were going to die, Callahan says. It's been a story for a long time, and every time the demise of theaters has actually been replaced by theaters doing better than ever. Surviving in trying times. Adam Birnbaum has represented dozens of movie houses across the country for years. Birnbaum, owner of the Nova Theater Circuit in Connecticut, handles negotiations with movie studios on behalf of theater companies, including several clients in North Carolina. There were a number of underperforming locations across the country, many of which were outmoded theaters with a lack of amenities or years of deferred maintenance, he says, of the industry before the pandemic. At that point in their lifespan, they had become obsolete or simply not viable. Florida-based Frank Theaters was one such theater chain. filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in December 2018. Filings submitted to the U.S. Bankruptcy Court District of New Jersey show that Frank Theaters lost about $31 million from 2016 to 2018. The chain had five locations in North Carolina at one point and 26 locations overall across nine states, according to the defunct company's Facebook page. In early 2019, the Southern Pines Pilot reported the town's Frank Theaters location, Sand Hill Cinemas, had been in poor shape for years. Along with customer complaints of unsanitary restrooms and crumbling ceilings, the cinema was also deemed unsafe by local fire inspectors and was forced to temporarily close in May 2018. Mike Whalen, the CEO of Florida-based Paragon Theaters, says the creditors of Frank Theaters had hoped to reorganize the company, but eventually folded. Paragon bought three of Frank's assets to renovate and rebrand, including the Parkside Town Commons Theater in Cary and Sand Hill Cinemas. Frank Theaters also had a location in Sanford, but Paragon rejected that lease due to the poor condition of the interior, Whalen says. The costs to renovate that location were more than Whalen deemed worth it. Why would I want the Paragon name and the brand that we've created to be associated with something like that, he says. Paragon Theaters. Raleighwood Cinema Grill, one of the Triangle's first dine-in movie theaters, couldn't compete with at-home entertainment and filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy in December 2019, just months before the pandemic began. In a Facebook post at the time, owner James Keene said that the family-owned theater could see the writing on the wall. Attendance has steadily decreased over the past two-plus years as large flat-screen HDTVs and streaming services have changed the way people enjoy movies, Keene wrote. A trend to releasing new movies directly onto streaming services, bypassing theaters, has begun. The independent theater and restaurant operated for 26 years in the Falls Village Shopping Center in North Raleigh. The bankruptcy filing estimated Raleighwood's assets at about $3,000 on liabilities worth more than $777,000. Still surviving is the Rialto Theater, which was one of the Ambassador Entertainment's four theaters in Raleigh, but is now the only location left operating. First to go was the Colony Theater in 2015, which had operated in North Raleigh since 1989. Mission Valley Cinema near NC State University's campus closed for good in September 2019 after being open for more than 45 years. In October 2020, Ambassador Entertainment announced that Six Forks Cinema was closed until further notice. The space at 9500 Forum Drive had housed a theater since 1986, but could now be transformed into 12 stories of mixed-use development, as reported by Triangle Business Journal in July 2021. The Rialto, now an only child, is in its 80th year of operation in Raleigh's Five Points neighborhood. Peebles joined the theater in 1989 and has worked to restore and the property since. Passion has kept him running the theater, even during the difficult past several years. The months-long closure of the theater in 2020 is a time that Peebles says he doesn't like to talk about. He calls it either the year after 2019 or the year before 2021, likening the time to the Harry Potter character Lord Voldemort. The theater saw slightly better revenue figures in 2021, and Peebles is expected 2022 to continue on that upward path. We show movies. We change people, hopefully for the better, and I enjoy that, Peebles says. In 2019, we were doing extremely well. Right now, we're paying the bills, but it will get better. You just don't recover overnight. The massive Fenton development under construction in Cary, set to open its first phase next month, includes a movie theater. In October 2019, Fenton developers announced that CMX Cinemas of Florida would open a 35,000-square-foot luxury dine-in Cinebistro theater. 6 months later, CMX Cinemas filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The news led the Fenton team to call around to other upscale movie theater companies, pitching for someone to fill space. In January 2021, Paragon Theaters announced its agreement to take over the space. The national theater chains with a Triangle presence have also experienced financial distress over the last several years. National operator AMC was on the brink of bankruptcy at the end of 2020, but was saved by an individual investor, Army, organized via Reddit. Cineworld Group, owner of Regal Cinemas, also narrowly escaped filing for bankruptcy protection at the end of 2020 by agreeing to give lenders 10% of the company. Dine-in theater chain Alamo Drafthouse filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in March 2021. As of now, the New Bern Avenue Alamo Drafthouse location is still open. Switching gears. North Carolina movie theaters were forced to close in March 2020 at the onset of the pandemic and weren't allowed to reopen until October, and then only at 30% capacity. With little revenue, local theaters scrambled to stay afloat. The Rialto began selling its popcorn online for pickup at the theater, tote bags featuring a photo of the theater and paintings of the Rialto. The company also started a GoFundMe page, which raised more than $35,000. The Chelsea Theater, an independent nonprofit movie theater in Chapel Hill, raised over $125,000 through letter writing and a few phone calls, Executive Director Emily Cass says. Once it became apparent that the lockdown wouldn't be short-term, the team came up with a plan and a budget for totally overhauling the interior. The $125,000 plus another $25,000 from in-kind donations fully funded the makeover. The 4,000-square-foot space got a new lobby, bathroom, new seats, screens, sound system, carpeting, and an air filtration system to pandemic-proof the space as much as possible, Cass says. The renovated space reopened in March 2021. During the closure, the Chelsea also began offering a small selection of films to pay to stream on the theater's website. Though not a big source of revenue, the program kept Chelsea patrons engaged with the theater while at home, Cass says. The Lumina Theater in Chapel Hill also took advantage of the forced closure to revamp the theater. The theater's previous owner, local development company Brian Properties, opened the spot in 2000 in Southern Village. In the summer of 2019, Brian Properties announced the Lumina would be closing due to low attendance. A group of local angel investors swooped in to buy the Lumina in November 2019 under the name Save Ferris LLC. Filings with the state show Aaron Westrick of Ruffalo Noel Levitz, Susan Dancy of Rockwood Development Group, Andrew Blass of Atlantic Private Wealth, and Danielle Blass of Blass Law as affiliated with the LLC. The group had renovation plans in place, but the pandemic brought those to a halt, says Francesca Mason, chief financial officer for the Lumina. The theater pivoted to offering outdoor movies in the summer of 2020. By the summer of 2021, the Lumina was ready for construction to begin again, and the new owners brought on the help of Carrboro-based restaurant management company Damn Good Food. Mason and her co-worker, Callahan, working for the management company, now oversee the theater's daily operations. Renovations are still taking place with a full bar and food concept planned. The idea ultimately is that we'll have the food and beverage options to offer guests more than just movies to attract them to the space, Mason says. The Lumina received $1.12 million in federal funds through the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant, or SVOG, program. But that money didn't go toward renovation costs, Mason says. The $16 billion program was designed to offer emergency assistance to performing arts and theater businesses forced to close during the pandemic. But the grants can only be spent on operational costs. Therefore, the Lumina owners are fronting the costs for the renovation themselves, Mason says. Also receiving grants in the Triangle were the Chelsea Theater, $307,441, the Rialto, $194,146, the Varsity Theater in Chapel Hill, $101,650, and the Carolina Theater of Durham, $1.8 million, according to the U.S. Small Business Administration. Is there a future? Capacity restrictions are lifting and theaters are beginning to operate as normal, but the future of the industry remains uncertain. Streaming platforms are more prevalent than ever, and local theaters are still seeing low attendance. Changes to the independent theater business model must be made, the Lumina's Mason says. Back in 2018 and 2019, when streaming services started taking off and started producing their own content, it was an early indicator of movie theaters needing to reinvent themselves to compete and give people a reason to come out that's more than just movies, she says. Independent theaters learning to market themselves is a key factor to survival, Mason says. Customers can see movies at other theaters through streaming services, so offering a full experience is Mason's goal. Movie booker Birnbaum, who represents the Lumina, the Rialto, and the Carolina Theater of Durham, says the value of food and beverage components in theaters has become abundantly clear. Offering food and alcohol along with amenities like plush seating and high-quality sound systems is the future, he says. At the Cary Theater in downtown Cary, operations and program supervisor Lanny Simeona is planning to offer events at the theater in connection with movies. The theater, owned by the town of Cary, has offered Christmas movie sing-along events in the past. Simeona wants to add offerings such as Mamma Mia sing-along screenings with props and goodie bags and discussion conversations after films to make the movie experience more interactive. Paragon Theaters, currently open at the Parkside Commons, Parkside Town Commons in Cary, and opening soon in the Fenton Development, has three pillars in its business model that ensure the company's success, CEO Whalen says. The first is getting the right price in real estate transactions. When making deals with landlords, Whalen assumes box office revenues will eventually make it to $8 billion or $9 billion, but not to 2019's $11 billion. The second piece is run operationally better than theaters in the past, and the third is to upgrade theater facilities. Paragon's basic ticket price of $6 is much lower than competitors, Whalen says. The low price is possible because it brings in more customers and also because of Paragon's diversified revenue stream. Traditional movie theaters operate with ticket sales making up 65 to 70% of their revenue and concessions making up another 25 to 30%, Whalen says. Paragon locations see about 40% of their revenue come from ticket sales, with the rest coming from added amenities such as bowling alleys, arcades, and food and beverage concepts, he adds. I hope revenue numbers return to what they were before, but we're not banking on it. Our projection is somewhere between 80 and 85% of what it was, Whalen says. You have to expand your mind and think about what you have as a facility and how you can differentiate yourself. How to survive in these changing times is a hot topic in the industry, Simeona says. As for the Cary, she's betting people still value watching movies in person. As someone who watches a lot of Netflix and streaming programs myself, there's something about the shared cinematic experience that I think is really hard to beat, she says. What's really important is how adaptive you can be with your space and your programming. Birnbaum is expecting the industry to continue shifting, but where and when the dust will settle is unknown. While movie theaters evolve, the net number of locations at the end of the next 2 to 5 years will be less than what we have now, he says. While we will absolutely see new theater locations come on board and open in certain marketplaces, Birnbaum says, I have to imagine that the number of theaters that close will far outnumber the number of theaters that open. And now we turn to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Finding the Ability in Disability, How Triangle Businesses Are Seeing the Benefits of Employing the Disabled, written by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ+ community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. Hiring people with disabilities can be an intimidating prospect for many employers. There are misconceptions that workers with disabilities pose greater risks, would be less productive or less reliable, all false assumptions. After studying 13,000 workdays in a manufacturing operation where more than 75% of the hours were from employees with significant disabilities, faculty at Michigan State University found that productivity increased when the number of workers with disabilities on a team was increased, and it was most effective when people from across the disability spectrum were employed. Mental disabilities, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD, and physical disabilities were among 10 disability categories included in the study, which concluded, the strongest teams on the factory floor were inclusive and diverse in terms of disability. Teams that had more workers without disabilities did not have higher productivity. Too bad the Caterpillar plant in Clayton didn't have that information when they opened in 1992 and chose not to offer a job to Mike Atkins. But 30 years ago, few manufacturers would have considered hiring a person in a wheelchair. There has been a lot of jobs I applied for and didn't get, says Atkins, who was injured in 1988 when he was thrown from his pickup truck and broke his back. They would say I didn't get hired because of job qualifications, but I disagree. At least half of those jobs I was qualified for, and the other half, with a little bit of training, I could have done. Since 2017, Atkins has been a rehab specialist with Stahls Medical, working at WakeMed Health and Hospitals, doing chair setups and repairs for patients in acute rehab and at the Children's Hospital. Out of the 34 years of being hurt, I've only not had a job for about 2.5 years, he says. In his current job, he's found his perfect calling because of his passion for helping people, as well as his ability for working with his hands and assembling pretty much anything from high-end wheelchairs to motorcycles. People should have an open mind about hiring a person with a disability, Atkins says. The disability does not define the person. Just because they're in a chair doesn't mean they can't get on a computer and run circles around other people in the office. Atkins, who grew up in Pembroke and is a registered Tuscarora Indian, was a 26-year-old working on a loading dock operating a pallet jack and contemplating a career as a tractor-trailer driver when he had his accident. His first job after the accident was assembling boxes for an industrial company. Next, he worked in data entry and putting together mailings for Duke University. Then he worked in office administration for the Alliance of Disability Advocates, or ADA, in Raleigh. That's where Jerry Stalls, owner of Stalls Medical, found Atkins. Stalls and his wife, Deb, started the Assistive Technology and Medical Equipment Company in 1990. The Cary-based company's annual revenue runs $12.5 million to $13 million. They have offices in Charlotte, Greensboro, and Greenville, and at least 25% of their 43 employees have some sort of disability. Before starting this company, I worked for about 9 years in vocational rehab, where my sole focus was to help people with disabilities transition back into competitive employment, Stahl says. In my experience, when you provide an opportunity to a disabled person, you have someone who will work extremely hard. Progressive attitudes and new technology are making it easier for people with disabilities to join the workforce. 15 or 20 years ago, a person with ALS was basically bedridden. Now, an ALS patient can drive a power chair by starting at a laptop mounted on their chair, Stahl says. Independence has been greatly enhanced because of advances in electronics and technology. Atkins also co-founded the Triangle Thunder, which is in Division II of the National Wheelchair Basketball Association, and placed third in the 2018 National Tournament. I'm a wheelchair basketball Hall of Famer, way better at wheelchair basketball than I was at stand-up basketball in high school, he quips, adding most of his high school basketball was spent warming the pine. A wheelchair or other visible disabilities can be disconcerting for those conducting a job interview, but it's probably more difficult for them to ask questions about the disability than it will be for the applicant to answer. Vicki Smith, executive director of the ADA, says businesses should routinely ask everyone they interview, is there anything we can do to ensure your success? Anything you might need that would make you more productive? Of the 18 employees at ADA, 14 have some sort of disability. Not all of our staff have visible disabilities. Some have speech impairment, hearing loss, or a diagnosis of a mental illness, Smith says. The message really is, if you are interviewing a person with a disability and you can see that or they've disclosed that, just ask them straight out what they might need. The person applying knows what they need to be successful. The ADA will assist businesses in helping to understand how to navigate hiring from the disabled community. Smith recently did a presentation and immediately got a call from a warehouse manager who said, I want to hire the people you work with. In addition to employing disabled workers themselves, another way a business can support this community is to follow the example set by Pendo and partner with companies such as 321 Coffee. At Pendo's new headquarters in downtown Raleigh, the coffee shop is operated by 321 Coffee, a mission-driven coffee company that employs individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, I/DD. Lindsay Rieg and Michael Evans started 321 Coffee in 2017 and hired their first employees in 2019. Until then, it was staffed with I/DD volunteers. Their first location at the NC State Farmers Market is open weekends. The Pendo location is open 5 days a week, so we have 6 baristas who work 20 to 30 hours each, more than we could offer at our farmers market shop, says Rieg, CEO. People with disabilities are often limited in the number of hours they can get, so they juggle more than one job. What we heard was, I don't want more jobs, I want a real job. The Pendo shop lets us give them substantial hours. Plans are underway to open another location in downtown Raleigh this summer, and the ultimate goal is to open more 321 coffee shops, ideally in corporate settings like Pendo. This allows us to immediately create new jobs for our team, and it's such a powerful way to bridge the gap between I/DD and employers, he says. When hiring managers can see our baristas taking orders and operating the point of service, basically running the shop and working in a meaningful way, I hope we will start a chain reaction to inspire others to be inclusive when they hire and build teams. And also in the 52 Shades of Success section, we have a column written by Carrie Bird, who is vice president of the Triangle Native American Society. Bird is a former development officer at UNC Chapel Hill and former president of the National Indian Education Association. The headline, An American Indian's Perspective on the Various Shades of Success. What are you? It's a question I've been asked many times. American Indians or Native Americans, what's the appropriate terminology to use? I choose to use American Indian because it's the identifier I grew up using. It's also the terminology most familiar to others. But the term Native Americans has grown in popularity. I've even been corrected by non-natives insisting I'm wrong in using the term American Indian. Really? Actually, the most correct way is to identify us by our tribal affiliation. Oh, you're Lumbee, Kohari, Waccamaw, Siouan, etc. We are an invisible population group. We blend. That can be good from the standpoint of having overt discrimination displayed toward us. It can also be bad when we're in situations when others are sharing racist jokes or saying something unflattering toward another racial group. We suffer in silence. The phrase people of color sounds inclusive, but is it? How about BIPOC, a new term that has come into existence, meaning black, indigenous, people of color. We are such an underrepresented group, we leave us out, or lump us in, a generalized term of recognition that includes almost anyone who isn't white. There are over 3.7 million Native Americans in the U.S., according to the 2020 census. In North Carolina, the number was 130,032, or 1.2% of the state's population. North Carolina has the second largest Native American population among states east of the Mississippi. New York has the largest. In the state, there are 8 state-recognized tribes: Kohari, Eastern Band of Cherokee, Haliwa Saponi, Lumbee, Maharan, Okanichi, Band of the Saponi, and Waccamaw Siouan. 4 urban Indian organizations are also recognized by the state: Cumberland County Association for Indian People, Guilford Native American Association, Metrolina Native American Association, and Triangle Native American Society. The tribes and urban Indian organizations each have representatives who sit on the board for the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs. American Indians living in North Carolina have experienced various forms of discrimination throughout history. While they are known as having been friendly to the first visitors to this land, over time the population was decimated by disease, warfare, and the encroaching needs of settlers for their lands. American Indians have faced discriminatory practices in education, transportation, dining, shopping, employment, and housing. And in many reports, voting, employment, housing, we simply aren't mentioned as we're too few in number to make the cut. The underlying message, we don't matter. Many times I've been the only American Indian in a college class, on a committee, at work, or in the room. I have been asked to present the Native perspective on a committee or to speak about American Indians in a school classroom. Oftentimes, these requests stipulate they'd like for me to dress up in a regalia and feathers and demonstrate a dance. Yes, we're often seen as a performance piece. In urban areas, we're often overlooked, though we exist in plain sight. 52 Shades of Success. We succeed simply by existing. Maintaining our identity in an ever-changing world is a constant. Our message is, we're still here. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings in the Triangle Business Journal. It's written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, Change to Come. Change is coming at a Raleigh museum that has been a big hit since it reinvented itself. Marble's Kids Museum is looking to hire a replacement for longtime CEO Sally Edwards. Back in 1999, the building rose as Exploris, a museum of the world that had an interesting concept but not enough guests. It just was not getting the visitation that was expected, Edwards says. Meanwhile, Play Space was a huge hit, with parents and children cramming into its location in Glenwood South. Edwards, who grew up in Raleigh and went to Sanderson High School, was hired to lead the new Marble's Kids Museum in 2007 as the two concepts were blended together. Marble started with a budget of only a few million dollars and annual visitation of under $100,000. But before the pandemic, the space grew to a budget of $9 million and $700,000 annual visits. Even now, Edwards says the budget is around $6 million and visitation is surging again. Given that, Edwards felt it was time for new leadership as Marbles weighs how to expand and add capacity and see those projects through. It's been an incredible 15 years, and it's time to pass the torch, Edwards says. There is so much moving in the right direction. North Carolina makes a move against Russian vodka. Governor Roy Cooper made headlines when he announced sanctions against Russian alcohol in the wake of the country's invasion of Ukraine. Among the orders from Cooper, the state's ABC commission is to halt all sales of alcohol produced by Russian entities. So in other words, vodka. As it turns out, Russian vodka isn't so popular in North Carolina. And overall, Russian vodka brands account for just a slim percentage, a little more than 1%, of the vodka sold in the U.S. For example, the top liquor in the state by sales is Tito's Vodka out of Austin, Texas, and Smirnoff Vodka. Well, it started in Moscow, but today the brand is owned by a British company, Diageo. Here are some Russian vodkas that fall under Cooper's order. Russian Standard, Beluga Noble and Beluga Gold Line, Hammer and Sickle Vodka, and Zier Vodka. Shaw University lands grant. A historically black university in downtown Raleigh has landed a $150,000 grant to help preserve its historic buildings. Shaw University is one of five HBCUs to receive a grant from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit awarded a total of $650,000 to the universities through its African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund. The funding will help Shaw, which was founded in 1865, develop a campus-wide plan to support and coordinate ongoing preservation of its campus. The funding will help Shaw add more buildings to the rehabilitation it has undertaken at two of its historic buildings, Leonard and Etsy Halls. Shaw will also receive resources for a paid student professional development opportunity, through which a student will work with a team of architects, engineers, and consultants. From educating the former enslaved to educating to graduating some of the first African-American doctors to helping ignite the civil rights movement, the legacy of Shaw University is woven into the fabric of American history, Shaw President Paulette Dillard says. Love for Paris of the Piedmont. Carrboro is one of the best small art towns in the country, according to a report by news publication 24/7 Tempo. The Orange County town ranked number 5 in the country, according to the report. Numbers 1 through 4 on the list, respectively, were Marta, Texas, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Woodstock, New York, and Northampton, Massachusetts. And excuse me, that's Marfa, Texas. Carrboro, referred to as the Paris of the Piedmont, is home to about 21,000 people, and places like the Art Center, a nonprofit education facility that offers classes and showcases performances and art exhibits. Outsider banks high on Forbes list. Two out-of-state banks making big pushes in the Triangle had lofty perches on the Forbes 13th Annual America's Best Banks list. Ranking number 9 was Town Bank out of Virginia, and coming in at number 22 was Pinnacle Financial Partners out of Tennessee. The list looks at growth, credit, quality, and profitability to rank the 100 largest publicly traded banks and thrifts. Of the North Carolina-based banks, Truist ranked number 69, First Citizens number 79, and Bank of America number 91. And finally, new job search? You're not alone. North Carolina ranks 6th in a new report, one that ranks states with the most people looking for work. The survey out of Career Board LENSA shows heavy demand in the state amid what some have dubbed the Great Resignation. But the state isn't alone in seeing heavy click activity on job boards. North Carolina is behind Texas, California, Florida, New York, and Georgia. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech and Travel page, written by Lauren Onisorge. He's pitching new way to find vacation home. Durham entrepreneur has a plan for those in search of getaways. For years, Durham's Matt Williamson was known as the guy in the green pants, a branding staple of his predictive marketing firm, Windsor Circle. When the company was acquired in 2018 by Output Services Group of New Jersey, he stayed on for a while before folding up the pants and moving to his next venture, Plum Co-Ownership. No, he doesn't yet have plum-colored pants. Not yet, he jokes. But he does have a concept, a website, and a $1.5 million funding haul to get started on a company that helps people acquire vacation homes. For Williamson, sitting still wasn't an option, he says. I just love the art of creating, he says. I have been very fortunate to have worked with a lot of teams, but at the end of the day, I think I feel most alive with that kind of early stage creating process, doing a lot of brainstorming and risk taking to see if we can shape something beautiful out of nothing, out of thin air. It started on vacation. Williamson and his wife travel with groups of friends regularly, and toward the end of the trip, they go through the common lull of not wanting it to end. Somebody says, why are we renting this place? He says, why don't we just buy a place together? Everybody's like, huzzah, but nobody actually knows how to get started. Plum fills that need, helping groups find each other, organizing the sharing process, and even connecting buyers to real estate agents. Our model is to make sure that people have made all the decisions they need to make. They've set their budget and agreed as a group they're going to do this. Then they enter the market just as any other buyer, Williamson says. We think there's strength in numbers. Right now, it's just Williamson, but with the cash he's raising, he hopes to add to the team. A securities filing shows $50,000 has been closed. The pre-seed round will total $1.5 million, led by Studio VC, with participation from Tweener Fund, which is led by local entrepreneur Scott Wingo. Demand is high for RDU's Iceland flight. With under 3 months to go before Raleigh-Durham International Airport's inaugural nonstop flight to Reykjavik, Iceland, all systems are go. That's according to Iceland Air CEO Bogi Nils Bogason, speaking in an exclusive interview with Triangle Business Journal. Bookings have been strong, he says, adding that all that remains is waiting for the May 12 takeoff. Bogason says the airline's Icelandic heritage is a major differentiator. It offers Iceland stopover packages where tourists can spend a few days in Iceland before moving on to a final destination in Europe. Our mission is to bring the spirit of Iceland to the world, Bogason says. We focus a lot on being an Icelandic airline. We are coming from Iceland, so first of all, we would like the people in your area to know that Iceland is a great tourist destination and a great country to visit. Space plane firm to expand in Durham. A company hoping to commercialize outer space through new space planes is hiring. Colorado-based Sierra Space is the developer of what's called the Dream Chaser, a space plane that launches atop a rocket carrying it into orbit and can then glide back to landings on an airport runway. The company, which has 40 employees in Durham, announced it would be doubling its 1,000-person staff and starting a space launch operation in Florida. Russia's Ukraine invasion fallout. North Carolina's exposure to Russia, at least in terms of trade, is relatively minuscule, according to data from the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. Russia is the state's 39th largest export market. Here's what Russia was buying from North Carolina companies in 2021. Wood pulp, $24.5 million. Tobacco, $22.3 million, and pharmaceutical products, $13.6 million. And finally, in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Josh Stein, North Carolina Attorney General. It's important for businesses to realize that this battle in Ukraine will not be limited in scope to those geographic borders. The internet makes us all subject to the consequences of war. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page written by Zach Gizone. RTP facility produces plant-based vaccine. Health Canada gives approval for vaccine made by Medicago. A manufacturing facility in Research Triangle Park is producing the world's first approved plant-based COVID-19 vaccine. Health Canada has granted approval for a vaccine called Covifens that's developed by the Canadian biopharmaceutical firm Medicago. GlaxoSmithKline is also involved in the effort and produces a pandemic adjuvant which enhances the immune response. The Canadian government has committed to purchasing 20 million doses of the vaccine with an option to purchase 56 million more, says Medicago's medical officer Brian Ward. The majority of these doses will be produced at the company's facility in RTP. In December, Ward said the company of about 800 employees, including third-party contractors, hired more than 150 workers over the last year to prepare for the rollout of the vaccine. A large portion of these employees were brought on to scale up production at the RTP facility. In addition to obtaining this license in Canada, Medicago is pursuing approval in other countries, such as the U.S., Ward said. The company, based in Quebec, plans to submit its final package to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration this year, and that the review process could take between 6 to 12 months. With this first approval, the company isn't planning an expansion of its RTP facility, but it could be open to the possibility with some help, Ward said. The company has held discussions with the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency and the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority about a potential partnership. The company built the RTP facility through a 2010 partnership with DARPA. We're positioning ourselves to not be just a pandemic vaccine company, but a real vaccine company, and having an enlarged facility in the U.S. would help us better facilitate North American preparedness, Ward says. In addition to stretching the vaccine's geographic reach, the company is exploring other uses for the vaccine, which showed an overall efficacy of 71% in clinical trials. Ward said Medicago plans to begin a study in a few weeks testing the vaccine as a booster dose and a pediatric study in early summer. We had a whole half of a day to celebrate the licensure, and now we're back to being pretty busy, Ward says. UNC initiative to fight pandemics to build leadership team, hire CEO. An initiative founded at UNC Chapel Hill that's focused on developing therapies to fight the COVID-19 pandemic and prevent emerging threats has landed $18 million in state funding. The rapidly emerging Antiviral Drug Development Initiative, or READDI, R-E-A-D-D-I, plans to use the funding, which was included in the most recent state budget, to build out a small management team and hire a CEO, according to a statement from UNC's Eshelman School of Pharmacy. The university launched the Global Public-Private Partnership in 2020 with the goal of developing a number of antiviral drugs that could be effective against entire families of emerging viruses to treat people during future pandemics or epidemics. The initiative also received $5 million from RTI International late last year. The goal is to raise $125 million for its initial launch and $500 million overall, said John Bamforth, Reddy's interim director. The initiative is also aiming to have 5 drugs ready for phase 1 testing within 5 years. We can't predict when future pandemics will strike, but we know they will, Bamforth said. These investments will help the state and nation better prepare for future global pandemic threats, including those from a novel coronavirus. RHO running autoimmune studies for NIH. RHO has secured a federal contract worth potentially more than $49 million. The contract research organization based in Durham will serve as the Autoimmune Diseases Statistical and Clinical Coordinating Center for the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. In this role, Roe will provide clinical trial design, development, implementation, and project management services for studies within the Institute's autoimmune branch over the life of the project. The 5-year contract is being funded with $8.3 million in its first year. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from University of North Carolina System President Peter Hans on keeping tuition rates flat for in-state residents for the 6th consecutive year. 6 years of stable or falling tuition represents tens of thousands of students who have enrolled with more certainty, studied with less stress, and graduated with less debt. And finally, a big number, $61.2 million. That's how much an ag tech firm headquartered in Research Triangle Park has raised in an ongoing funding round. The company, Vesterin, plans to raise another $40.3 million, according to a February 15 filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. Shoppers watch, wait on Crabtree future. Raleigh Mall is up for sale as malls across the U.S. see changes. Crabtree Valley Mall has been frequented by Triangle residents since it opened in 1972, but as its 50th birthday nears, the mall's longtime owners are looking to sell. The 57-acre property's high-traffic location makes it a likely candidate for redevelopment into a mixed-use center, leaving some local shoppers concerned for the mall's future. Raleigh resident Nicolette Nicolette Hemmer visited Crabtree Mall recently to purchase a new cell phone at the Verizon Wireless location inside the mall. Hemmer says she values in-person interaction, so she opted to head to the mall where she could see all of her options and speak to a sales associate instead of shopping online. Hemmer, originally from Syracuse, New York, moved to the Triangle in 2019. As far as malls that she's visited, Crabtree Valley sits about middle of the pack, she says. A perk of shopping at Crabtree is always feeling safe, but the mall could offer a wider variety of amenities, she says. Hemmer would like to see Crabtree Valley mimic a mall she frequented in Syracuse called Destiny, New York. There are go-karts, movies, arcade games, nighttime bowling, escape rooms, she says. They have more activities, so it becomes more of a destination and not just for shopping. While shopping in Crabtree on a rainy afternoon, Christine Robinson says she didn't want to see the mall go away. Being able to browse through all of the stores without worrying about the weather is a big plus, she says. Robinson moved to Fuquay Varina from Pennsylvania a few years ago and noticed that many malls in Pennsylvania were being turned into mixed-use developments, a trend she doesn't want to see happen here. One employee at Yankee Candle says that foot traffic inside the mall has remained high. As online shopping is taking away business from in-person stores, many companies are adapting to fit the new demand. The Crabtree Yankee Candle location does a lot of online business, according to the employee. However, in-person shopping can't be replaced, she says. Crabtree Mall is owned by a foreign limited liability company, CVM Holdings. The LLC is managed by Chandon Investment Company and owned by a group that includes the family of former Abu Dhabi President Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan. Popular Durham restaurant finally reopening with big-name chefs. After being closed to dine-in service for 2 years, popular downtown Durham restaurant Littler is reopening, and it has added some big-name talent in the kitchen. Known for its new American fare and cocktails, the restaurant is located at 110 East Parrish Street. The Little Jack Toro Group, owners of Littler, Jack Tar, and the Colonel's Daughter, and Pizzeria Toro, announced that North Carolina natives, chef Elizabeth Murray and pastry chef Tanya Mata will be joining Littler. Murray most recently served as executive chef at Sierra Mar at Post Ranch Inn, a luxury hotel in Big Sur, California. Mata most recently served as executive pastry chef at popular restaurant The Gray in Savannah, Georgia. Mata started one of Durham's first mobile food brands in 2008 with the launch of Daisy Cakes. She has also worked as a pastry chef at Fairview Restaurant at the Wilmington Duke Inn and Golf Club and former Raleigh restaurant Nana's Chop House. Longtime Durham firm opens first retail space. Couch Oil Company, a family-owned business for over 70 years, has expanded its offerings to include couch and company, fireplace, and patio. The retail showroom, located at 4630 Hillsborough Road in Durham, is a first for the company and will sell gas fireplaces, fire pits, outdoor kitchens, and grills. The company currently offers propane gas, heating oil, diesel fuel, and gasoline to customers. The retail building totals 1,500 square feet. Couch gutted the space, a $100,000 investment, he says. Indoor fireplaces will likely be popular at the store, he says. The store offers built-in outdoor kitchens, which could be attractive to custom builders. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Empire Properties founder Greg Haddam on news that the CVS will move out of the Raleigh building of Fayetteville and Fayetteville and Harget Streets. "We look forward to having somebody in there that is really excited about being on the corner of Main and Main, if you will." And finally, a big number, $28.4 million. That was the price tag in a recent deal for a retail center across from Triangle Town Center Mall. The price is $2 million less than the property's last sale in 2016. The Dick's Sporting Goods anchored center is now owned by an affiliate of AR Global. And now we turn to a better world inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene, where we'll read the nonprofit briefs. Prison Support Group gets a generous donation. A donor who wishes to remain anonymous has spent $3.9 million to purchase a building for CLI Prison Alliance, formerly Christian Library International. CLI Prison Alliance will relocate to 3001 Spring Forest Road in Raleigh in a 27,500-square-foot building it can use rent-free. The Alliance will use about 11,500 square feet of the space to start out. Founded in 1996, CLI donates Bibles and other Christian material. In 2020, the organization shipped over 300,000 Bibles and books to inmates around the world, including Mexico and the Philippines. The new space includes expanded warehouse space, room for more than 100 volunteers at a time, a dedicated training room, a fully functioning kitchen, and space for international efforts. Spectrum donates gift to Cramden Institute. Cramden Institute has received a $30,000 Spectrum Digital Education Grant for the Computer Basics for Seniors curriculum as part of its five-year, $7 million commitment to digital education in Spectrum communities across the country. Funding will support Cramden's collaboration with a variety of community partners in the Triangle, Fayetteville, and Sanford areas, providing four sessions of Computer Basics classes and educating up to 150 senior citizens. Along with comprehensive basic computer training, each participant will be awarded a refurbished laptop computer with 1 year of complimentary tech support. We applaud Cramden Institute for their broadband education initiatives and for helping us support efforts that promote digital literacy, said Rahman Khan, Vice President of Community Impact for Charter Communications. And finally, NCCU professors get grant to build digital history. Two English professors at NC Central University have been awarded a two-year, $98,420 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to help them digitize the university's history. Catherine Wimmer and Rachel Gold are co-principled investigators of digital exploration of North Carolina Central University's history and have worked at NCCU since 2008. As North Carolina Central University continues to expand its efforts in the humanities, this grant will provide faculty and students additional opportunity for hands-on training in digitization, says Carlton Wilson, interim dean of NCCU's College of Arts, Social Sciences, and Humanities. With the funding, NCCU will hold a five-day workshop this summer to teach faculty how to incorporate digitized materials about campus history into their classes. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page written by Evan Hoopfer. Development would energize Greenville. $300 million mixed-use project would add jobs in eastern North Carolina. There are two giant economic engines in Greenville, East Carolina University and Vidant Health, and a development team is looking to capitalize on the university's growing partnership with the health system with a mixed-use development called Intersect East that could bring more jobs to Greenville. It's right at the junction of commercial and campus, says Tim Elliott, managing partner of Elliott Sidewalk Communities, the project developer. And the 19-acre development sits near the intersection of 10th and Evans Streets in Greenville. Elliott Sidewalk Communities, based in the Baltimore suburb of Sparks, Maryland, works with college towns that have an economic engine that was once high and mighty and has failed, Elliott says. In eastern North Carolina, that was the tobacco industry. Some of the buildings on site were used in the tobacco industry of yore. And Elliott Sidewalk Communities is redeveloping those for the 21st century users. Since the project broke ground in October, Elliott says they've entertained about 14 tenants that have checked out the space. He says the first phase is scheduled for completion in Q1 2023. Subsequent phases include about 250 to 300 residential units, Elliott says. He adds that the capital investment for the entirety of Intersect East is pegged at a little over $300 million. North Carolina, like other Sun Belt states, is experiencing an economic boom thanks to its comparatively low cost of living that has attracted both people and companies. This project aims to bring Greenville in on the boom. Everything I see in North Carolina for economic momentum is always Charlotte to the Triad and over to Raleigh, that crescent, Elliott says. Only 80 miles to the east is Greenville, which I consider the capital of eastern North Carolina. That's what this project is, to connect it from no longer being a part from that crescent, but a member of that crescent. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Project raises concerns. Business owners say planned apartments threaten their shops. A new mixed-use development in Durham has already seen pushback from neighboring businesses and residents amid fears the new designs will disrupt operations and could cause at least one business to close its doors. Last month, Florida developer Ram Realty Advisors filed plans for the six-story Washington mixed-use project, calling for 311 apartments over ground floor retail at 501 and 703 Washington Street and 706 West Corporation Street. It also sits next to a cluster of Durham businesses, some of whom say the development will disrupt business and could spell the end of operations for at least one of them. At issue for Durham distillery owner Melissa Katrinchik is a planned retaining wall that would be built as part of the development, which she says would make it impossible for trucks to access her loading dock. If they build that retaining wall, they've taken away our ability to do our jobs, Katrinchik says. You can't take pallets of 2,000 pounds of glass off a semi onto a lift gate. It can't hold that weight. You have to go in through a loading dock. Without that access, she's unsure how she can continue operating. Katrinchik estimates moving the operations would cost up to $4 million. One door down, Blue Note Grill owner Bill Whittington says he always knew the property would be developed eventually, but is concerned about the impact so much development would have on customer traffic. Across the street, another development is planned called The George, and he's concerned that work on two major construction projects could turn that section of Washington Street into a dead zone while the work is ongoing. At Durham Distillery, Katrinchik says that could be the end of her business. It's so hard to know whether this would be worth continuing, and I say that because every step of the way, building a distillery and building a brand has been hard, she says. I left a lucrative job to do this, and I'm not sure if I'm not going to be forced to go back to that and not run a business anymore, and that's heartbreaking. That's been my dream, and I can't imagine losing that because I can't fit a truck behind my building. And finally, in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll mention the Viewpoint page, which usually we will turn to read the editor-in-chief, Sugata Mukherjee's column. But in this edition, the entire top of the page is blue, the bottom is yellow, in the colors of the Ukrainian flag, and at the bottom there's a hashtag that says, Pray for Ukraine. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.